Hello, and thanks for joining us for a WTTW News special, COVID Lessons 5 Years Later. I'm Brandis Friedman. 5 years ago today, our country and our lives changed forever. The World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a global pandemic. And Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker was about to issue a statewide stay-at-home order in effort to control the virus.
To avoid the loss of potentially tens of thousands of lives, we must enact an immediate stay-at-home order for the state of Illinois.
As the world shut down, the virus impacted every aspect of our lives. Business owners especially had to make adjustments so their livelihoods could survive.
This was my dream. I always think about, oh, you know what, I want a coffee shop, I want to do this, I want to do that. But we used to have a lot of people waiting for tables, and right now it's empty.
The pandemic and subsequent vaccine rollout exposed disparities in healthcare as Black and Latino residents were significantly more likely to contract the virus and die from it.
It's unacceptable. No one should think that this is okay. And we have to step up in this moment and step into it.
All that leads us to today. What did we learn from COVID-19? And is the country prepared for a future pandemic? We explore those topics in the next half hour, right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by the Alexandra and John Nichols family, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
More than 1.2 million Americans died from COVID-19. Despite having one of the most sophisticated healthcare systems in the world, the U.S. response to the coronavirus pandemic fell short when compared to other developed nations. So 5 years after the World Health Organization declared a global pandemic, is the United States any better prepared to weather the next pandemic? Joining us to help answer that question and more are Dr. Garth Walker, Medical Director of Value-Based Care at Rush University Medical Center. Dr. Robert Murphy, Executive Director of the Institute for Global Health at Northwestern Medicine. And joining us via Zoom is Dr. Samir Vohra, Director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. Doctors, thank you all for joining us. I want to start by asking each of you what you would say some of the main lessons the United States and in particular our healthcare system have learned or think that we should have learned from our experience of the COVID-19 pandemic. And Dr. Walker, I'll start with you, please.
Sure. I think when I reflect back to 5 years ago, there were definitely some wins, particularly in the notion around developing a vaccine, operationally being able to distribute it across the United States. But when I think about opportunities of improvement, particularly around health equity in our marginalized communities, one of the biggest takeaways I took from there when I was at the Illinois Department of Public Health was just how fragile our primary care structure was and how we need to ensure that we're thinking about populations and trying to make sure they're healthier when a future pandemic presents itself again.
Dr. Murphy?
Besides the vaccine, which was a remarkable achievement in a matter of 10 months, if you asked any expert about vaccines in March of 2020, not one of them would have said that a vaccine could be developed within that year, that calendar year, including Tony Fauci, head of NIAID, who was basically responsible for the development of this. Everybody was wrong, and that was a good thing because it happened so quickly. By December, you had a vaccine on the market. That was incredible. It was effective, kept people out of the hospital, kept people alive. So that was one thing. The second thing was the treatment. There's a treatment. There are several treatments out there. The first treatment occurred really months after the pandemic start. That was also remarkable. Fortunately, it was a drug that was being used for other diseases that they just moved into the COVID sphere, tested it, it worked. And then the third thing that worked was testing. I don't know if you remember back to 2020, you couldn't get a test if your life depended upon it. I mean, that was a complete disaster. But the U.S. government came in again with a project called RADx, Rapid Acceleration of Diagnostics for COVID, and within a little over a year's time, we went from 0 tests per day to 8 million tests per day. So those three things are really phenomenal.
And you talk about the vaccine. That also speaks to the importance of research, because the research upon which the vaccine was based, the mRNA technology, had been researched, you know, started 20 years
before.
Sooner. Dr. Borah, same question to you.
Well, I'd say that we at the state of Illinois and the Illinois Department of Public Health have been thinking about this topic quite a bit. And just a little over a year ago, we released a COVID after action report that emphasized some of the strengths and then areas in which we could apply lessons learned. We were very fortunate at that time to have strong central leadership with Governor Pritzker, also a data-driven response focused on addressing disparities. But what we learned was that through our governmental systems, especially our public health systems, we needed to focus on preparedness. We also had to modernize our systems, both the kind of taking real-time data into action, as well as elevating our workforce. And finally, how important communications was during the pandemic, being able to engage communities, build trust, taking those advances in science and really applying them around across the state to ensure that we could have the healthiest communities all across Illinois.
Dr. Murphy, how would you say the effectiveness of the U.S. response compared to that of other countries? And for those countries that had the lowest per capita mortality rates, what did they do differently?
We did the worst of, well, we came 19th out of 20 of the 20 highest income countries. I mean, really a pathetic score. And the reason for that is that we gave up on the mitigations too early, and we left it up to the states. So we stopped the masking, we stopped the social distancing, people stopped taking the vaccines or didn't take the vaccines. Our mandates on vaccines all were lifted very early compared to other countries. Like, for instance, in France, which has a much better result than we do, you couldn't go buy a cup of coffee in a coffee shop without a vaccine card. You know, you couldn't leave during the height of the pandemic. You couldn't go more than a quarter of a mile from your home without a significant purpose to go, like to visit a doctor or something. We had nothing like that. And that's why our numbers are actually the worst, or 19th out of 20, in the high-income world that we live in.
So, Dr. Borah, accepting that hindsight is, of course, 2020, what were some of the mistakes that you think were made during the pandemic that could be avoided, if possible, in the future?
Well, I do think that, and as we kind of continue to face challenging times in public health, the importance of having those cornerstone partnerships between the governmental systems, academic systems, healthcare systems, like the three of us on this call, critical to ensuring that we could have kind of real-time action. How do we modernize our systems in big and meaningful ways? And one of the focuses of how do we speak to these complicated public health and healthcare topics in ways that we can get individuals to understand the unification of health and community health and the importance of that. We know that we are learning those lessons and trying to apply them in real time here in Illinois, but it'll continue to be a real sort of state of vigilance for us to maintain our preparedness now into the future for any kind of public health emergencies that arise.
Dr. Walker, you mentioned this, and we know that, of course, black and brown communities in particular had higher mortality rates than white communities in the U.S. What do we know about the cause of those disparities and how that might be addressed in the future?
Sure. I think when we think about different communities and different ethnicities that are affected differently by pandemics, we have to think about the social determinants of health, the barriers to be able to get access to vaccines, as well as their participation in research trials, to be able to be positioned well, to be protected. I think one of the wins from COVID-19 was that we did have equitable representation in the development of those vaccines. But that doesn't necessarily replace the role of trust and the role of building trust. And regardless whether you're part of the private sector, public sector, gaining trust is a full-time job. And communities have rightful hypothesis to be able to question accordingly. So I think being able to continue on those partnerships that were just mentioned, build those partnerships deeply so that when a pandemic presents itself in the future, you can operationalize the distribution of vaccines needed as well as the education to be received for those communities.
Were you surprised by those disparities back in 2020 when it was coming to light?
Not at all. I think the evidence and the research around the disparities among different groups was very deep, very convincing, and well known amongst those in the field. The challenge was how do you react towards it and build the trust and be able to affect the communities that needed to be affected differently.
Dr. Murphy, do you think the key lessons to be learned, are they medical, political, a little bit of both?
The medical, I think, were on target, I think, as the reasons I already stated. But this is a disease that is the most political disease that I think has ever really happened. Not that pandemics aren't filled with politics. I mean, it goes back to smallpox vaccination back in the 17th century in Boston, where when they discovered variolation, which is a form of smallpox vaccination, the leaders of the community who were promoting it because it worked, they had their houses stoned and firebombed. People thought, it's against God's will. It's just not a natural thing to do. And so that feeling today, and then with this pandemic, it continues, and it's just a huge tragedy. What will happen with the next pandemic when we now have states with laws built in where you can never have a mask mandate? You can never have a social distancing mandate. I mean, it's built into some laws in some of these states. These people are really going to be put at odds. And to follow up on the issue with the underprivileged minorities, because of the great efforts actually that went on in this state and many others and many people, those vaccination rates and treatment rates went up significantly during the pandemic. And in the middle of the pandemic, when the politics came in, do you know whose rates actually got worse? White males. White males actually started doing worse. We were doing a study. We had to go out to, I won't name the suburbs, but we had to go out there and recruit them to get into a study to try to, you know, treat them.
So we're almost out of time. And Dr. Vora, I'm going to give you the last word on this because, there, you know, obviously there's a lot to talk about because we weren't able to get to the part about the United States withdrawing from the World Health Organization, which declared the global pandemic. But overall, would you say we are better prepared for the next pandemic? Is it bird flu? Is it measles?
Well, as you mentioned, just emerging challenges around public health. And I'd say that here in Illinois, we have invested in our preparedness, in our data systems, and in working around new and effective ways to communicate with our communities. But as the COVID-19 pandemic showed us, we are a ever interconnected United States and world. And we have to do everything in our power to maintain those important global relationships to ensure that we are taking every precaution to protect our residents here in Illinois and across the nation.
All right, that's where we'll have to leave it. The three of you obviously have your work cut out for you. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Garth Walker, Dr. Robert Murphy, and Dr. Samir Vora. Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, COVID patients who are experiencing complications long after their initial infection. For many people, COVID is still not yet behind us. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, roughly 3 in 10 adults who've been infected with the virus at some point experienced long COVID or long-term health problems from the virus. While clinical research is still underway, advocates say more help is needed for those living with it. Joining us with more on the illness are Marta Cerda, a long COVID patient, and Dr. Jerry Krishnan, a medical researcher at the University of Illinois Chicago. Thanks to you both for joining us. Dr. Krishnan, I want to start with you because you are leading an NIH research effort on long COVID. How is what we know about long COVID now, how has it changed in the last 5 years?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me tonight. I think we've learned a lot. I think first is we now know what long COVID is. We have a definition for long COVID. I think all throughout the United States and different parts of the world, we have a single definition, which is really the first step in making any advance. The second is we have a way of now knowing who's at risk for long COVID. This is something we didn't quite know before. So number one, these are individuals, particularly those who got sick with the earlier variants of long COVID, the pre-Delta and the Delta variants, where maybe 20-30% of people developed long COVID. Now we know with the more recent strains, it's closer to maybe 5%, maybe 10%. So we know that we're on the path towards viruses that are much less likely to cause long COVID. We also know women are at higher risk, people who have more severe illness are higher at risk, those who are not vaccinated, and those who get recurrent COVID infections. So we now know the target populations we should be most worried about. The third thing that we know is that we're now developing greater expertise in diagnosing long COVID and developing multidisciplinary clinics to help individuals who are suffering from long COVID.
So some progress made, it sounds like. Marta Cerda, you've had long COVID for nearly 5 years because you did contract it kind of early on. It was October of 2020, yes, that year. What has that been like for you the last 5 years?
Very challenging. I had a very severe case of COVID in October, as you said, 2020. And then for months, I realized my smell and taste just did not return. And it took me a very long time to connect the dots to realize that I had long COVID, even though I'm a healthcare executive. It's hard to understand how everything relates to your long COVID. So what I deal with on an annual basis or a daily basis are health issues with my brain. I have trouble with brain fog, stuttering, anxiety attacks. My heart will race even though I'm at rest. My lungs are scarred, so it's harder to recover from illnesses. And then I have stomach issues that may last for 3 months. So that's another part of long COVID. People don't know that you can have a certain issue that you had when you had COVID, but it will last, instead of for a couple of weeks, for 3 months. And plus, I have a debilitating, what's called post-exertional malaise, so that's fatigue. So even if I walk a short distance, I become very tired.
So imagine all of that put together can be life-changing for you, just
absolutely,
in the activities and the responsibilities that you're allowed to keep up with.
Correct. I have to make accommodations. I have to rest. I have to plan for my time. And I have to work to stay as healthy as possible to manage the symptoms that I have.
Dr. Krishnan, why is it such a challenge to diagnose and treat? And why haven't we invested more in research and training?
Yeah. So the first thing is we just have to remember that this is a new condition. 2019 is when the virus was identified as causing pneumonia-like illnesses. I think you heard on the previous segment how quickly we were able to make progress in developing vaccines. So this is a new illness we're learning. And I guess if you were to put this in the context of maybe the HIV pandemic, I think it took about 10 years from having the virus identified to having effective treatments that converted what was uniformly a fatal disease to something we could manage more effectively. And now we're in a completely different situation. We're talking about treatments maybe every 6 months, that it's just a pill that you take every 6 months or an injection. So I think we're early in the phase. As I said, we now know what long COVID is. We're trying to now figure out why do people get long COVID and how do we effectively treat it and what are the longer term consequences. Go ahead.
Well, sorry, I just wanted to also mention that according to a study from the RECOVER program that you are a part of, compared to white patients hospitalized with COVID-19, black patients had approximately twice the odds of being diagnosed with diabetes and 1.5 times the odds of being diagnosed with chest pain in the 30 to 180 days after infection. And similar differences were also observed for Hispanic individuals. Marta, have you seen, or how have you seen, Latino communities struggle to access care for long COVID?
Well, we were down in the trenches trying to vaccinate people, and many people did not know how to access a vaccine. They were afraid of going to clinics because of traditional fears. So that was problem number one. People were afraid to get treatment or to get help in the communities. So we were on the ground in the churches and the food pantries trying to help people who are hardly reached in our communities, just even to access care. So that's a very big problem because they aren't able to address their health issue and they get worse and worse.
Dr. Krishnan, what other types of health inequities do you see communities face that might put them at risk for long COVID?
Yeah, I think the first, Amartya said this really nicely, is really access to care. And I think we've made great strides in that. I think we now have community health centers. We have greater access through insurance. But I think this is an area that we need to continue to do our work. The second is, I think, reaching these hardly reached communities and really raising the awareness, just as Marta is doing now. Marta, along with the Illinois Unidos and University of Illinois Chicago and other groups, are really going out to communities and building trust to talk about long COVID and engaging them in conversations. So I think the main point is recognizing those symptoms, getting help early, and going to places that have expertise in long COVID.
Marta, you've been advocating for increased awareness about long COVID. What types of benefits and supports do people with long COVID need?
They need to be able to get to clinicians who understand the illness. My own clinicians don't understand it. When I told them all about these symptoms I mentioned to you, they look confused and they don't know what to do. So you need to go to long COVID clinics or deal with physicians who understand the illness, who they can find treatments or deal with your particular issues. Otherwise, you can continue to get worse, and some people drop out or unable to work and have very serious consequences if they don't address their long COVID with the experts.
Dr. Krishnan, we've got like 20 seconds left. What more would you like to see?
Yeah, I think it's useful to kind of recognize that we're on the path here towards having major discoveries made on the treatment of long COVID. Both Marta and I and others are actually part of national consortia that are launching clinical trials. So I would say this is an opportunity for all of us to be part of the solution and learn about the research that's going on and join and participate. And let's get this solved quicker together.
All right. Best of luck to you both. Thank you for joining us, Marta Cerda and Dr. Jerry Krishnan. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Up next, Chicago welcomes a monument to commemorate the COVID-19 pandemic. But first, a look at the weather. Chicago is creating a physical space to remember the COVID-19 pandemic that had the world locked down. In an effort to honor those killed by the virus and as a tribute to essential workers who risked their lives, Chicago will soon be home to a global monument.
Chicago was the first to have a medical district. So, of course, we should be the first to have a COVID-19 monument in the medical district.
So this is the monument honoring all of the frontline and essential workers and those who passed. I had the idea, but I didn't have the place.
What we have behind us is the, you know, sort of the center of the district, and it's where all the hospitals can see into a space. And we wanted to create something green and beautiful here. So we've been in conversations with the community about what they want and what they need here in the IMD.
What should a monument of honor, remembrance, and resilience look like? Our jury chose a submission from a young art professor, a sculptor, Casey Schachner. It features sculptures that are a hybrid of the COVID virus and the dandelion flower. It's a visual metaphor for the virus and for hope and resilience.
So Chicago responded to the COVID-19 pandemic by coming together. The communities really started to work together, the nurses. The resiliency of Chicago really shone through.
Chicago will be the site and city of the world global monument that honors frontline workers.
We want a place where people can come and play and come and relax and have an opportunity for health and wellness and healing right in the backyard of Chicago.
This monument tells society we can do it. We did it. We came together and we survived a world pandemic.
Really, we've had this amazing opportunity to bring something beautiful to Chicago that will last for generations and will shine a light on Chicago and how we took care of each other in one of the darkest times.
And the monument is slated to make its debut in the city's medical district in 2026. And that's our show for this Tuesday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that is proud to be a multilingual law firm that provides translators for a variety of languages.